David Goodrich retired from his position as head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Observations and Monitoring Program. What does a retired climate scientist do? Ride a bike across America, of course. Find out about his epic journey. It's all new and all blue. Join us next. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. David Goodrich was one of the nation's leading climate scientists as director of the UN Global Climate Observing System in Geneva, Switzerland. When he returned to America, he found the reality of climate change transformed into a tangled political mess. After retiring, he decided to observe firsthand the effects of climate change on the ground and to talk to ordinary Americans about their views on the subject. He did this in a series of epic bicycle rides, including a 4,200-mile-long trip from Delaware to Oregon in 2011. His memoir of these adventures, A Hole in the Wind, A Climate Scientist's Bicycle Journey Across America, was published by Pegasus Books earlier this year. He joined us via Skype from his home in Maryland. David Goodrich, welcome to Blue Dot.
It's great to be with you, David.
Let me start off by asking a really basic question. Why is the title A Hole in the Wind?
Well, when I was originally planning a cross-country bike trip, I was thinking that Kansas was going to be the easiest state and that I would, you know, I could rack up 80-mile days because it was flat. And I discovered once I got out there that the genesis of the word Kansas is Kansa, people of the south wind, with the emphasis on wind. So I was having days where I would have 20 to 30 mile an hour headwinds. So in going across Kansas, the first thing I would look for when I woke up in the morning was a hole in the wind that I could pour some miles into.
And so your bicycle journey takes place in 2011 and starts from Delaware and ends in Oregon, right?
Yes, it does.
So tell us about your career as a climate scientist, because you're retired now, right?
Yes, I am. Yes, I started out of college, basically taking a job with NOAA on the NOAA's oceanographic ships, and did things like nautical charting and current surveys in Chesapeake Bay. And along the way, I got degrees in marine science and oceanography, and ultimately came to work in NOAA's Silver Spring headquarters, working on climate and the ocean, especially. But we were working on prediction of El Niños, and ultimately, I came to work on climate observing systems, on global climate observing systems, and ultimately, I worked in the UN in Geneva. There's a group there called the Global Climate Observing System that's under the World Meteorological Organization. And that was a fun job, but it was basically trying to make sure that the things that measure climate change in the ocean, the atmosphere from satellites, stay in place and are in the right places and can be maintained for over the long haul.
You have a great quote in there when you're talking about your time in, it's Geneva, right?
Yes.
Where you said it's the great Satan meets the axis of evil.
Yes. I in one of the first times when I took the job, the building at World Meteorological Organizations, this glorious steel and glass building looks out over Lake Geneva. And I had a project that that called for me to meet with the first vice president of the World Meteorological Organization, who was also the head of the Iranian Weather Service. And I remember walking up the stairway just thinking, the great Satan meets the axis of evil. How cool is this? And when I came into his office, these were very, very competent people. They're kind, friendly, and interested in the same things that I was, because climate is inherently an international kind of thing.
And for those of our listeners who have forgotten, the great Satan was the United States, according to Iran. And the axis of evil was, I believe, George W. Bush coined that about North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, right?
Yep, yep, that was it. That was it.
How I miss that guy, George W. Bush, right now.
Sometimes, yes.
And then you have a quote near the end of the book by Robert Frost, Two Tramps in Mud Time, I believe it is. I thought that was beautiful. And explain to us what that meant to you.
Well, for me, my avocation was riding a bike. I enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it for many years. And the thought occurred to me that perhaps as I had finished my career in climate at NOAA, that I could talk with people about climate on the way across, and to combine what I did for a living for 36 years with what I particularly enjoyed doing, which was long distance bike rides. And I thought that I could talk with people on the way across, as well as seeing what climate change looks like on the ground on the way across.
One of the things I most enjoyed about the book, like any kind of journey book, of course, is the journey and not the destination, was the people, the interesting people that you meet. And I found there was a common theme there, that you found that the American people were extremely kind and generous and helpful to you. But you also found out that changing their minds about climate change wasn't very easy.
No, not at all. I think everyone is interested in talking about what the latest drought is doing on the coast. People will talk about, hey, we seem to be getting flooding a lot more often. But when you change that subject and put it into from what me as a scientist, from what I see as logically, well, this is climate change, right? Then it's almost like the wall tends to go up, that people will talk about the weather, but they don't really want to talk about the climate so much. And I certainly had some wonderful people that would take care of me. I imagine I'm not the as a solo cyclist. If I were a crook, I'd have the slowest getaway car imaginable. So I'm not too much of a threat. So people will really take care of you, especially almost the more remote places you are, the better they'll take care of you. And sometimes you can almost see where they're coming from. There was a guy that I met in Wyoming who was a pastor of a church and also a long distance cyclist. And he said, I just can't believe this climate change stuff. When I look at at the size of the sky and the scope of nature, I can't believe that we as humans can actually change it. And I was saying, yep, that's sometimes it seems hard to believe, but we have U-2 aircraft that go across that take measurements in the atmosphere above the South Pole, and they can measure compounds that are found in our refrigerators. So that the influence of humans on the climate is actually quite pervasive, but not necessarily easy to show. Things tend to move rather slowly.
I've had almost exactly the identical experience with some people with what you just said. And one of the things that struck me as I was reading that is I recall you were at a church service on Sunday, and then you were getting ready to kind of duck out, and the guy grabbed you and said, hey, come on and have lunch with us. Is that we as humans, we live on the world and it seems so large. And one of the things that I've always been struck by is that the astronauts, when they're up at the International Space Station or the Apollo astronauts, they see how thin and fragile the atmosphere truly is.
There's no question. There is almost one of the more potent arguments that you get is that nature is so huge, but as you say, when you start looking at the planet as a whole, and about what a thin little piece of atmosphere we have covering it, that gives you quite a different perspective.
I think it was Carl Sagan that said, used the analogy that if you're talking about a classroom globe, the atmosphere is one coat of varnish.
Yeah, that's about right. That's about right.
Let's talk about some of the iconic places that you saw and how you observed climate change and things that are definitely changing over time in our lifetimes, because we're about the same age. We can't go through all of them, but pick out a couple of that stand out for you, that where you really observe changes going on.
I was going up. I had about a 5,000-foot climb outside of Fort Collins, Colorado. I had a 2-day climb and was really getting beat up pretty badly. I made the top at the pass at Cameron Pass at about 10,000 feet. And I looked around and the trees are all dead. It's basically not dying. You've got a forest that is gray with a couple of trees that are still around. So I went to what I'd heard about was the mountain pine beetle. This is a bug that has always been in the forest, but used to be killed off over the winter times by 20 below winters. They don't have 20 below winters in the high Rockies anymore. So the bugs have really kind of gone crazy. This is the mountain pine beetle, and the mountain pine beetle has killed tens of thousands of acres, actually about 40 million from Colorado clear up to British Columbia. And it's the kind of thing that if it happened in a week or a month, then it would have been headlines all over the country. It certainly hasn't been a headline here back east, but it's one of the clearest impacts of climate change that I've seen.
An argument that you run into a lot with people is that, well, the climate has always changed. You know, you find fossils of tropical plants up in the Arctic and things like that. And you had some interesting counters to that argument. I think it was that with that same gentleman. Could you maybe share that with us?
Well, we've had climate cycles for a long time. There are cycles of climate change that are associated really with wobbles in the Earth's orbit that we can see those very clearly. But what you can see in the past, really, if you look at a record of climate in the last 1,000 years or so, you can see temperature basically coming out of the noise. You're seeing what has been called, actually quite accurately, the hockey stick. It looks like a relatively relatively stable climate, and now temperature is starting to go up quite rapidly. The thing that always convinced me about the human side of climate change is that you can get records of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for 800,000 years out of bubbles of ice in Antarctica and Greenland. And we can see that temperature and carbon dioxide have walked together for hundreds of thousands of years. And right now, against the scale of that ice core record of carbon dioxide, our carbon dioxide level is off the stops, and temperature is beginning to follow that. But we're way out of the natural range of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that's exclusively due to things like burning fossil fuels and deforestation.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our conversation with retired climate scientist and bicyclist David Goodrich. Stay with us. And we're back. We're talking to David Goodrich, author of A Hole in the Wind, A Climate Scientist's Bicycle Journey Across the United States. Why do you think that in America, the awareness or acceptance of climate change as being human caused is so far apart from what you see in Western Europe, for example?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with how big and important an employer the fossil fuel industry is. I mean, oil and gas employs a tremendous number of people in places you don't necessarily expect it, like Pennsylvania. I mean, never mind Texas and Oklahoma, but tremendous number of energy jobs in Pennsylvania. You'll see pump jacks in Kansas. You'll see pump jacks in Illinois. These are the iconic pumps that go back and forth on the, you can see them on the, out on the horizon sometimes. But there is a lot of people's livelihoods depend on the fossil fuel industry. And one of the things that we've come to realize is that if we're going to stabilize climate, we need to keep about 80% of those fossil fuels in the ground. That's not necessarily very good news for oil companies, for people that work for oil companies. It's not necessarily bad news. I mean, I found going across the country in 2011 that Kansas, I hardly saw any wind farms in Kansas. That's completely changed by when I drove across last summer, where you see all kinds of wind projects in the central U.S. I mean, the biggest wind energy producer, wind energy producer is Texas. The biggest wind energy project in the world is going up in southern Wyoming. So things are starting to change, but there are an awful lot of interests in having us keep burning fossil fuels, much less so in Europe.
And you've got lots of friends, I'm sure, that are climate scientists, many, many friends. How are they dealing with the current political climate with the Trump administration?
In some ways, people that have been around and working for a while have seen this before. Not necessarily the particular cast of characters, but there's going to be, you know, there are clearly big budget cuts coming in the climate science community. The head of OMB says we don't need to spend any more money on climate science. So that is disheartening. But I remember back in the Bush 2 administration, there were people in the Council on Environmental Quality that were basically editing climate reports to essentially add uncertainty to what the scientists had written. It basically said, when we say, yeah, we're pretty confident that this is a climate impact, that those reports would get edited to say, well, we were really kind of unsure about this, all is kind of blurry. That kind of thing is disheartening. It's the kind of thing I would say we can expect to see again. We've seen the climate websites taken down at EPA. So that's the side that's probably a little more disheartening to the people that are working in climate inside the government.
Well, you observed, of course, a lot of interesting things along the way in terms of climate change. But what did you learn about America and Americans from your trip? What were some of the big takeaways for you about this huge country we live in and its people?
Well, I think I found more than anything, just bumping into people, as I mentioned, that will tend to take care of you. I mean, I found in central Wyoming, of all places, there's a 120-mile stretch where there were no motels at the time. And I was figuring I'd have to camp on the way across. So I'm into this 60 miles, kind of knock on the door of a cafe, and they say, oh, yeah, you can stay in the trailer next door. We put up cyclists all the time. And so I think you aren't necessarily going to convince people on your particular point of view, but I think people will listen to you. And in the back of their minds, they are seeing things starting to change. It's almost like when you broach the C word, if you mention climate, you're basically taking it into a political realm, and people don't necessarily like to talk politics with strangers. But I think also in the center of the country, you aren't going to necessarily have to convince people that climate change is the real thing, is a big deal, as I certainly believe. But you can also say, and you may be able to make some money out of this. The solar energy industry, the wind energy industry, these seem to me to be the industries of the future. And I think I think Wall Street agrees with that. I think it was a couple of weeks ago where the value of Tesla became greater than General Motors. That may have dropped back in the last week or two, but it's almost the market saying this is the way that the future is going to run out. And I think people ultimately are going to realize that. They realize that that their growing seasons have changed in the West. They realize that the fire seasons are now way longer than they used to be. And eventually, I think people will come around. I came away with a very good feeling about the fundamental intelligence and the very helpfulness of the people that I ran into riding across.
And you also made an observation that I thought was interesting. I think a lot of people would be afraid, even if they were fit, to travel across the country on a bicycle for fear that something bad might happen to them. It's dangerous out there. And yet you said you saw more danger in sitting inside.
Yeah, I think we're both of a certain age that it almost seems like the bigger dangers are of the sedentary variety. I found that, riding across the country certainly was a lot of work. I sort of viewed it as I had a job for 5 hours each day to, ride about 12 miles an hour and punch out 60 miles. That was my job, and the rest of the time was just gravy. I got to watch stuff and think up stupid jokes and think up stuff for the blog. But the one thing it does is that, your cardio is pretty good after that. You don't have to be in monstrously good shape to do it. But I found that staying on that sitting on the couch in a lot of ways is more dangerous. That the things like diabetes and a lot of the heart disease come from our more sedentary lifestyles. And if you can kind of get away from that, then it seems to me you're better off. But the dangers on the road are really overstated. There was a truck driver. I sat and talked with him at a truck stop, and he said, "Oh yeah, there's no way we'd hit you. It's too much paperwork." And and it's like that. People, I had some close calls with cars, but now I've ridden, if I total everything up, I've probably ridden the equivalent of around the world, and haven't gotten hit by a car yet. Haven't taken a few falls, but not that many. So it's not as dangerous as you might imagine out on the roads.
And what's next for David Goodrich? Are you planning any kind of climate-oriented rides in the future? Maybe like a ride for climate, kind of like a March for Climate or March for Science, but get a bunch of bicyclists to ride for climate?
I've actually done that a couple of times. There has been a New York to DC climate ride that a group called Climate Ride Sponsors. It's really a lot of fun. Takes about 5 days to get from Brooklyn down to down to Capitol Hill. We actually had a couple of years back, Senator Sanders came and spoke to us. So I've done that. I have some ideas about where to ride next. I'm thinking about possibly going up to Fort McMurray, where the oil sands are, and taking a ride down from Fort McMurray in Canada, down through Alberta, Saskatchewan to Williston, North Carolina, which is where the Bakken, the center of the oil shale production in the U.S. has been. It's almost like these are the two biggest, newest areas of fossil fuel development, certainly in North America and some of the biggest in the world. It would be interesting to see them up close and to talk with people about it, because I did a similar kind of thing. I've ridden through Pennsylvania now three times through the hydraulic fracturing regions in Pennsylvania, and that's a remarkable sort of boom and bust story.
Well, we're about out of time, but briefly, what's the main takeaway you would like to have people get from your book?
Three quick ones. First, that climate change is not something for your kids or your grandkids. It's something that's very much here now. And that, in fact, a lot of climate change is baked into the system. That the greenhouse gases we already have in the atmosphere are going to continue the warming and the sea level rise that we've seen. But I believe that there really is a lot of hope for a transformation in the way that we make energy. And that just the fact that things may seem bleak on the federal government level doesn't mean that things aren't going on the state and local levels. Certainly around here in Maryland, they are. And that things are proceeding quite nicely on the international level. There's still 195 nations that have signed up to the Paris Accord, and they're moving right ahead. It's a little sad that the U.S. isn't with them, but things are moving, and that there is indeed hope.
Well, David Goodrich, thank you.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to climate scientist and author David Goodrich. His book, A Hole in the Wind: A Climate Scientist's Bicycle Journey Across the United States, was published earlier this year by Pegasus Books. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes on mynspr.org, subscribe on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our communications coordinator is Casey Gardner. Follow us on Twitter at NSBRNews or me at Dave Shlom. Blue Dot is co-produced and engineered by Nolan Ford on the board. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, was composed and performed by Matt Schiltz of New York City. For all of us here, I remind you there that we all live on a pale blue dot.